1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
How the hell are you, Higher Side Chatters? Welcome back to THC. I'm Greg Carlwood from sunny San Diego, drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, and trying to put my brain back together after one of my favorite interviews I've ever done. We talk about the deep connections between banking, alchemy, and physics, and follow this little bundle of hidden information through history and watch it come and go into the hands of various historical power factions. And I just think the level of clarity Joseph brings to such a complex, mysterious, and suppressed history is damn near unparalleled. But before we get it on, this is the last show of May, which means another money bomb where I give half of the month's donations back to a random listener. And this month was Will Casey. He took home about $235, so big congrats to him. I'm going to play his acceptance message, and then I'm going to recommend you pack your glass and park your ass because Joseph Farrell is dropping some serious knowledge on the other side. Enjoy.
Sweet dreams to the elite. We're calling them out on THC. Uncovering secrets and conspiracies. Everybody's looking for something.
Hey Greg, this is Will Casey, your most recent Money Bomb winner. Wow, I mean, this is awesome. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. I have a son on the way. Me and my fiance, we live up in Maple Valley, a small town on the edge of Seattle. And let me just say thank you very much for having such a great show. I wouldn't want you to change anything, and thank all the other THC listeners for, you know, doing the money bomb thing, because this is going to be great. I'm going to be able to put some money towards buying the last few things that we need for our son. And of course, I'm going to get a few shirts, because I really want to get the sheep with the suit and the bum with the sign saying quit your job. I like both those shirts. They both have a deeper meaning, and I think they're awesome. So, I mean, your show is great. I've turned a lot of friends onto it, and it's influenced our camping trips because we spend the whole time talking about how the moon could be a hologram or how the chemtrails are poisoning our minds. And it's cool that I don't even have to lead the conversation anymore because my friends have been listening, and now they do most of the talking for me. But for guests that you've had and topics that I like, geez, there's so many. It's really hard to tell. I mean, Lennon Honor was one of my favorites. He just had such a good message. And Daniele Bellelli, he was really great. Dave Matheson, Jim Mars, John Rappaport, they were all so good. I wouldn't want you to change anything about your show. But a recommended guest, I don't know if you've had him on before, Thomas Campbell. He's written quite a few books, and so yeah, he would be a great guest, I think. And wow, keep up the good work, man, and thanks again.
All right, people, we know there exist secret sciences and banking mechanics that various nefarious groups, families, and secret societies have hidden from us and used against the masses of the planet for a long, long time. But what might surprise you is the realization that this secret science and these tools of financial puppetry may be intimately linked. And this little bundle of knowledge has been a key factor in major events from the shadows of history, is responsible for many rises to wealth and control, holds the keys to zero-point energy, and might have been responsible for a devastating war in the ancient past. It's a huge can of worms, and today's guest, Joseph Farrell, is more educated in this saga than anyone I know. He's a PhD graduate from the University of Oxford and has authored about 24 books that explore these subjects, and throughout the series has managed to tie in many unsuspecting threads that I think provides one of the clearest and most reasonable narratives of hidden history, maybe anywhere. It's a true honor to have him here today, and I can't wait to dive into it. Joseph, my man, welcome to THC.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for doing this, man. I consider you one of the greats on my short list, and I'm pretty pumped. There's a ton to talk about and many pit stops I'd like to make on the historical timeline of the secret bundle of knowledge and its influence. And before we get into how it comes into play over the years, maybe to start, I could have you describe some of this hidden info in the Elite's toolbox and this connection between physics, alchemy, and financial wizardry that seems to be a very important thing for us to understand.
Well, this is a really weird topic because I kind of backed into it. I started researching for Babylon's Banksters about 3 years before I actually wrote the book. I usually write books kind of when you see a book. I've usually been researching on it for a couple of years at least before the book actually comes out. And with Babylon's Banksters, I ran into something very, very unusual, and it kind of, well, many things very unusual, but the one thing in particular that really grabbed my attention was back during the Great Depression, President Herbert Hoover, who you know has gone down in history as probably one of the most hated presidents in American history, Hoover had a kind of a typical laissez-faire attitude toward what government should and should not do in economic crises. And so he kind of, you know, just let things go where they may. But one of the most interesting things that he did do that is almost completely unknown is he appointed a man, an economist in the Commerce Department by the name of Dewey, D-E-W-E-Y. This is no relation to John Dewey or anybody like that. But this Edward Dewey was an economist in the Commerce Department, and Hoover tasked him with finding out why we always seem to have these cycles of booms and busts. And there were no really good economic reasons, as far as Hoover was concerned, why we kept having these things. And Dewey, of course, in the Commerce Department, he was just sitting atop this massive mountain of data. And so he started researching these cycles of booms and busts. And very early on, he became aware that biologists were investigating their own cycles. And so he thought, well, gee, this is interesting. Let's look at cycles in general. And Dewey wound up founding a foundation called the Foundation for the Study of Cycles, all right? This is still in existence, and it's located in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and they have quite an interesting database when you look at it, because they study cycles of every imaginable thing that you can conceive of. And Dewey published all of this in a book in the 1950s, the results that he'd amassed up to that point, called The Study of Cycles, The Science of Prediction, The Study of Cycles. And in it, he points out that almost any human economic activity has its cycles and waves, long, long waveforms that last years, be it in the production of pig iron, whatever sort of economic activity you can look at, there are present within it these very long cycles. And I was amazed at this, because Dewey then goes on to propose the idea that somehow these cycles, economic cycles, are related with other cycles. And with that, I thought, aha, right here we have the beginnings, perhaps, of a scientific basis for the study of astrology.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So let's go back and look at what the claims for astrology are back in ancient Mesopotamia and in ancient Egypt, and then go back to Dewey for a moment. If you go back to some of the texts, Egyptian texts, some of the Mesopotamian texts, one of the things that they will tell you, and this incidentally you can find in a book by the Egyptologist Wallace Budge. He wrote an interesting little book called Amulets and Talismans of Ancient Egypt. And in it, he points out that in the Egyptian text, the claim is made that astrological predictions were based on observations that had been taken over thousands of years. And the same claim is made in Babylon. And let's go further. When we look at ancient astrology, we've got to understand one key difference between it and modern astrology. You know, the kind of astrology you get in the grocery store aisles when you see those little books of sun signs, you know, on and so forth. Well, ancient astrology was concerned primarily with aggregate prediction. In other words, it wasn't predicting so much any particular individual person's future, but rather it was predicting the future of the king. In other words, it was predicting the future of a nation state or a city state or what have you.
Gotcha.
So there's this key difference, but the claim is made that, you know, they were basing all of this on observations made over thousands of years. So in other words, the claim is made that this is a science, not a pseudoscience. So let's go back to Dewey. I'm looking at all these cycles and looking at all of his explanations of them and his attempt to find a sort of grand unified theory of cycles. And I'm thinking that this is the beginnings of a modern reconstruction, perhaps, of some sort of scientific basis to the phenomenon of cycles, including astrological cycles, and incidentally, the Foundation for the Study of Cycles investigated things like that. So then I thought, okay, if this is the case, then we should have, at some point, a connection between the high financial power, both in ancient times and modern, and this study of the science of cycles.
Right.
And sure enough, when you look very closely at the Foundation for the Study of Cycles, you'll see present occasionally papers presented by members of big banks. I ran across one, for example, that I mentioned in Babylon's Banksters, that was prepared by an economist working for Mitsubishi Bank, which is not exactly a small little ma-and-pa bank down the corner, you know. So right. The financial interest is definitely there. And if you go back and you look at ancient times, one of the most interesting things that pops out is not only do you find temples aligned astrologically and so on, but you also find an alliance of the high financial power, the reason being that the temples had the moral probity, so they thought, you know, so people thought, to be involved with currency, to be involved with, you know, exchanging coins from one nation or king to another. So in other words, there's always been this deep connection between what I'm calling the high financial power and the high physics, if you will, or metaphysics power represented by religion back then. And this is, I've got to tell you, when I made that connection, a lot of things became clear, because if you look at history since then, you seem to find, no matter at what point of history you turn to, this alliance between bankers and esoteric sciences like astrology. And in more recent times, you certainly have this alliance between bankers and high physics projects. I mean, you only need to think of J.P. Morgan and Nikola Tesla, for example. So, you know, this is a persisting pattern. And I'm actually writing a book right now where you find the pattern yet again in a very weird place. But, you know, it's there throughout history. That's basically the bottom line.
Yeah, man, that is a great introduction to it, and it is one of the things that I think is the most intriguing about your work and really all of this alternative conspiracy culture, really. And, you know, something, when I heard you talk about it before, you mentioned that from the physics perspective, it seems like they are viewing time-space as a creative medium.
Right.
And fractional reserve banking is kind of a black magic version of negative creation. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. I talk a lot in my books about a phenomenon that I call the topological metaphor of the medium. And I have to set this up rather carefully. And any attempt to do so in a few minutes on a radio show is really not going to do it justice. But if we go back to ancient times and look at how they understood God and creation, and this would be true from the Hindus in India to the Neoplatonists, you know, in the Eastern Mediterranean, to the Mayans in Mesoamerica and so on, they all state that the world that we see, the world that we exist in, and our own existence, all descend from an initial, undifferentiated, primordial nothing. Okay, and when mm-hmm. I say nothing, I mean nothing. There's no human attribute that you can use to talk about it univocally. So not even the word existence can you apply to it univocally in the same breath and in the same way as you would apply to everyday existence. Mm-hmm. Now, this undifferentiated nothing, let's play a mathematical thought game. Let's imagine a function that allows you to somehow differentiate within that nothing. So once you do that, what do you have? Well, you actually have now three nothings. They're still nothing, but at least they're differentiated nothing. And the reason you have three is you've now made a distinction between one region of it and another. This is why I call it the topological metaphor of the medium. Okay. So you've got two regions, and then you've got a common surface, all right, between the two. So you've actually got three nothings. They're all still nothing. They're all still infinite. But now there's been information added to the system, all right? If you go on through this process and keep doing it, you're going to gradually end up creating more and more information in the system. So let's look at what's happening now. Because of this initial differentiation, what you have just done is you've started creating numbers. Because you can't number a nothing, mm-hmm. but you can number three differentiated nothings, all right?
Right.
So number begins to emerge. Now, what happens if you assign a numerical value of one to the initial nothing? Well, then the resulting nothings are fractions of one, okay? And as this process proceeds, you have what? You have an inflation of information, and if you look at it financially, you have a devaluation of the individual nothings, okay? Yeah. But if you understand that same metaphor in a very different way, then you could say that with each differentiation, you're creating a new number. So in other words, instead of one and fractions of one, you get one, two, three, four, five, and so on. Okay? So the thing about this metaphor that is very, very important for people to understand is that it is always capable of being interpreted in more than one way. This is a both-and phenomenon, not an either-or. Okay? But if you now look at the fractional part of it, and particularly the way that the Hindus begin to understand the metaphor, what they begin to say is that everybody or everything that comes into existence owes its existence, please note the financial term again, the terms of debt, to what has preceded them, okay? So in other words, inbuilt into our thinking is this, you know, we're talking about a metaphor here that's fundamentally physics related in nature. And yet, in order to talk about it, we often use financial terms metaphorically when we apply this metaphor. So right there, this is something that's very crucial for people to latch on to. Right there in this metaphor itself, you have the connection between a kind of metaphysical physics, if you will, and finance. It's there in the metaphor itself. And this is really what is going on, I think, behind the scenes when you have this connection to the financial power and religion and physics and astrology and so on in ancient times.
Yeah, It's definitely a bit of a mind exercise, but
oh yeah,
it yeah. does make sense when you really get into it. And so, where do we see this type of thinking take root in the ancient past in terms of banking and kind of enslaving a nation through a debt-based currency?
Well, a lot of it is, in my opinion, based on the metaphor of sacrifice, because this is the other thing that becomes very early on present in the Hindu thinking about it. If you owe a debt, then that debt is only repayable by sacrifice. Of course, this enters Christian thinking in the West too. So, I mean, I'm not trying to pick on Hindus here, but you know, it's very, very deeply related. If you look at the other way of looking at the metaphor with the creation of information rather than the fractionalization of it, if you look at it that way, then when you encounter systems like that, very, very seldom do they talk about debt or sacrifice. So what is interesting is if you turn to the financial aspect of this in ancient times, one of the most interesting things that you see is the transition from money as a medium of exchange representing, so to speak, the surplus in the state warehouse, or as we'd call it today, the gross domestic product. All right. So in other words, if you look at money in Sumer, if you look at money in Mesopotamia, very often this is simply represented on a clay tablet, and it's a receipt against the goods of the state, all right? Mm-hmm. So in other words, it's debt-free.
Right.
Okay? Now, at a certain point in history, when you see the rise of the great empires, there's a fellow out there by the name of David Assel that wrote this wonderful book online about all this, and I would recommend it to people because I refer to it heavily in Babylon's Banksters. What you see arise with the great empires is the transition of money from receipts issued on the state warehouse, so to speak, or the gross domestic product, as we would call it, to a system of money that is able to be exchanged in international trade. In other words, you can have your Sumerian clay tablets all you want, but they're not going to buy you much in India. Okay. So you have to have a medium of exchange that's valuable internationally in India, and that's of course bullion. But the problem with bullion back then is it takes a great deal to mine. And in the process of mining, the value of the bullion does not come up to the value of the cost of mining it. Okay, so what happens is you have the creation of what one scholar, another good book for people to refer to would be David Graeber, and it's a wonderful book called Debt: The First 5,000 Years. I refer to that book a great deal in Babylon's Bank, or pardon me, in Financial Vipers of Venice. It's a wonderful book. In that book, what Graeber describes is as you create these big empires, you're going to have to be able to pay the soldiers with money that's spendable in all the areas that they conquer. So that's bullion. So what you do is you enter the slavery coinage military complex, okay?
Well said.
Which becomes a vicious circle, because you have to have the military to conquer the slaves to mine the bullion to pay the military. Okay, so in other words, what bullion begins to do is, first of all, it begins to supplant these receipts on state warehouses, all right? And as it begins to supplant those receipts, the nature of money begins to change, because money is now conceived of as a debt owed to a certain class that's able to produce it and quite literally loan it into circulation. So in other words, we see also emerging at this time, we see the idea of monetized debt as money, all right? And we also see something else very, very significant. We see the rise of what David Assel calls bullion brokers. We see the rise of an international financial class that has more in common with that class in other nations than it does with its own, you know, with its own people. And that's been with us ever since. So, you know, this is a huge story. I mean,
it is.
I can go on and on, but I hope that's making some sense for your listeners.
Absolutely. And you mentioned sacrifice being linked in here. And of course, there's a long history of even, you know, human blood sacrifice. And also in conspiracy culture, a lot of rumors among the elite. Do you think that the actual practice of blood sacrifice could be some type of byproduct of this way of thinking?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. What happens in Hindu thinking is that initial nothing that then undergoes differentiation is viewed also, we have to understand how deeply this metaphor pervades ancient cultures and their thinking, because this physical medium that they're looking at, this is also the macrocosm of which man is the microcosm. So in other words, a human being represents in their very existence the whole universe. And as this universe undergoes the process of differentiation, well, what's happening is the body is being torn apart. At least that's the way the Hindu metaphor perceives it. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, sacrifice becomes a metaphor, a kind of analogical, magical working of the whole creative process. So in other words, to tap into the cosmological process, as far as this thinking goes, you have to perform sacrifice. Otherwise you're out of sync with it. I like to say, I like to put it this way in some cases, that what they're attempting to do is they're attempting to, so to speak, shock the physical medium by this act of analogical magic. Or to put it in much more familiar terms, they're trying to appease God or appease the gods.
Yeah.
So that, you know, they will have continual blessings bestowed. And of course, this really reaches the pitch of complete slaughter in Mesoamerica with the Mayans and the Aztecs. And it's very interesting. I have a book called Grit of the Gods, where I talk about the whole idea of sacrifice in that culture and then compare it to the underlying logic of sacrifice within Western Christianity. And please note I said Western Christianity, not Eastern Christianity. There is a difference. In the Mayan texts, it's very interesting to read that their supreme god, their wisdom giver, their civilization giver, Quetzalcoatl and Kukulcan and so on, did not approve of any blood sacrifice, human or otherwise. And that the rise of bloody sacrifices is ascribed to the working of sorcerers.
Oh, wow.
And one of the sorcerer's names happens to be a fellow by the name of Ya'atl.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. You know, there's that root word Yah that makes one wonder. So, yeah, there's this pervasive idea that sacrifice somehow shocks the medium or gives you some sort of power over it to manipulate it. And it's a very, very ancient thing, but we have to remember that in some cultures it is not the most ancient system, and that's even true in Hinduism. This is one of the reasons that Buddha's objected so much to Brahmanism is this whole idea of bloody sacrifice. So it's tied intimately to this metaphor, because if you look at that fractional system, as value decreases, the debt owed always increases. Mm-hmm. So in other words, in this metaphor is also tied up the idea of primordial debt. And so you see the idea of primordial debt entering the picture from, you know, Hinduism all the way to Western Christianity with Anselm of Canterbury. So it's a very, very huge story. I mean, you know, I certainly don't think I've exhausted it
by
any means.
Those right there are some great bullet points for sure. And the point you made about the Mayans is really interesting with the phonetic sound of Yahweh, because there are definitely researchers who try to make this case that when you look at groups who held this knowledge, the Knights Templar, ancient priesthood, secret societies, we see a lot of ritual and occult practice in general. And the connection some try to make is that this information is somehow extracted through making contact with some type of multidimensional or spiritual entity. Do you put any stock in that?
Well, I certainly don't object to the idea. You know, I have no philosophical objection to the idea that there are higher dimensional entities, angels, demons, or whatever you wish to call them. But I don't think it's necessary to go to the idea of getting these ideas from contact with any of those entities. Okay. I certainly don't rule it out of the case. But what I really am trying to show in my books that talk about this metaphor, and in effect all of them do in some form or fashion, what is clear to me is that this metaphor, if you want to think about the metaphor, you have to think about it in highly mathematical terms. In other words, the metaphor can be, and I've tried to do it in my books, can be symbolized or notated mathematically. It's when you put over the metaphor, the mathematical symbols can stand for things like primordial debt or things like fecundity of creation or fractionalization of information or what have you. In other words, the metaphysical systems of philosophy and religion are kind of what remote viewers would call analytical overlay to the metaphor, but they're not the metaphor itself.
Right.
In one of my books, I have a little book called Talk Radio for the Eyes, Transhumanism and Dialogue, that I wrote with my co-author, Scott DeHart. And in that book, we point out that three of the world's most famous, most well-known mathematicians all say something very unusual. The first one is René Descartes. And I'm paraphrasing here a bit because I don't have the book sitting right in front of me. But Descartes states, just a short little paragraph, that in his study of the ancients, the ancient mathematicians, he means, he's come to the conclusion that they had a form of analysis which they used to solve all their problems, but which is lost to us now. And moreover, he thinks they deliberately suppressed it. Well, you know, this is the guy that invented analytical geometry.
Wow. So
he's not a slouch. And then you look at Newton, and he says pretty much the same thing. Well, I've been reading these ancient mathematicians, and it looks to me like they had some form of analysis that they have carefully disguised or that has been suppressed or otherwise lost. And again, you know, this is one of the inventors of the differential and integral calculus. Okay. Right. So then you turn to Leibniz, who's probably, you know, the maddest of those three mad geniuses and probably also the most brilliant of the three. And and in Leibniz, it's even more detailed. He not only thinks that there's a lost form of analysis that the ancients knew, but that it was capable of mathematical notation and these are his own words, by a certain imitation of calculation that had nothing to do with numbers, you could solve all problems. And he goes even further and he says, well, I think I found some outlines of it. So in other words, I think what these three men discovered as they were, you know, ransacking ancient mathematicians and philosophical texts is I think they've run into this phenomenon that I'm calling the topological metaphor of the medium. And they were trying to, as I've been trying to do, they were trying to notate it. So yeah, I think rather than going to, you know, having direct contact with angels or demons, I think really all you need is a certain way of looking at ancient texts and, so to speak, reading behind the language to discover the pure abstract concepts and structure and functionalities at work. And that basically I'm calling the topological metaphor.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, man, outside of this financial wizardry, the physics side of this also has some technological implications on the positive. I guess, free energy on the negative, destructive weaponization, right?
Yeah, let's look at the physics aspect of this metaphor for a moment. I said, if you can imagine, you begin with one all-encompassing, non-differentiated nothing, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, in the physical sense, that's a real nothing. In other words, a something in physics has to be observable and measurable. So in other words, you've got a real nothing here that once the process of differentiation starts, what do you have? Well, now you have observable nothings, okay? So in other words, you're literally, the metaphor is literally a kind of a formal topological description in the barest fashion of a kind of creation ex nihilo, all right? Now, interestingly enough, if you look at the way that Christian doctrine, dogmatic theology, approaches God, they will say pretty much the same thing, that the essence of God is absolutely undefinable, that it is a nothing, mm-hmm. that every term that we would apply to it is essentially only used analogically, not univocally. So when they look at this, what do you see? Well, you describe God in the same way, infinite, incorporeal, omnipresent, and so on and so forth. Well, if you look at those descriptions, something that very early on occurred to Christian theologians is that these very same descriptions were applicable to space.
Wow. Yeah.
See? So in other words, you know, the theologians are looking at physics, and the physicists are looking at theology, if you want to look at it that way. So yeah, this has tremendous physics implications, because if you figure out the fact that the physical medium is a transmutative information creative medium, then once you've said that, what you're saying is that this metaphor is highly alchemical in nature. It's describing something or making assumptions about the physical medium, which is a nothing, incidentally, that is highly alchemical in nature, because everything that comes into existence is simply modifying the information content of that nothing. So, you know, this is a hugely physics-related idea. Because if, you know, let's just draw a simple analogy here. If you look at quantum mechanics, what are particles? Well, particles in quantum mechanics, like it or not, are not these little tiny billiard balls that we can't see. What they are collections of mathematical descriptions of functions and spatial relationships and so on and so forth. You know, quarks have fractional charges, 2/3 or -1/3, and they have a certain spin orientation, and you add them up together in the right way and you get protons and neutrons. You know? So in other words, the mathematical description of these things is taking over from substituting the idea that the description is the physical reality. So, you know, again, we're square back with this ancient idea that we have a purely informational content type of physical medium that very closely resembles in some respects the ideas of quantum mechanics. So, you know, this is a huge thing. I, you know, we could be here all day and all night and for several months discussing all of this, because it has almost endless permutations, and obviously it can go almost anywhere once you add that analytical overlay and start describing it in the language of ordinary language rather than the language of mathematics.
Mm-hmm. Man, it is definitely a little over my head, but I love listening to it.
Well, it's over everybody's head. Don't assume that my head is adequate to the task.
Right on. Well, you know, when you talk about these guiding principles being the basis for technologies, mm-hmm. or having practical applications, mm-hmm. and you look at the ancient past, you talk about there being an ancient cosmic war,
yes.
of ridiculously destructive proportions, which might have been this type of energy weaponizing it, might have been a catalyst for that.
Right.
And we also hear in the past a lot of whispers of a golden age, right, which you think about the positive aspects of this technology, it could facilitate a golden age. So,
oh, absolutely.
How do you think? Do you think there, I guess there was just a period of time before the rebuilding of human existence that this stuff was heavily involved in?
Well, yeah. I'm one of those people that I'm just terribly dissatisfied with the standard academic model that, you know, we were around for tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years doing nothing but hunting and gathering. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden we decided to get our act together and create Sumer and Egypt and the Indus Valley, you know, these civilizations that just all of a sudden out of nowhere spring into existence without any antecedent. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, this is a huge historical problem. This is not the way that most human history that we are aware of has proceeded. We build on something that has preceded us. So when you look at ancient texts and free yourself of the academic paradigm and really pay attention to what they're actually saying, they say these two things. Number one, there was a golden age, there was a high civilization, and if you read some texts, they give you hints, very strong hints in many cases, of a technological civilization that was at least the equal, if not far exceeding, our own pitch of development, okay? Mm-hmm. And they also say that that civilization literally blew itself apart in a war, be it, you know, the fall of Lucifer and the war with Michael and the archangels, or be it the wars that you read about of the gods in the Mesopotamian texts, or the wars of the first time in the Egyptian texts, or what have you. There's always this indication of some sort of cosmic cataclysm. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered is if you, and you know, I'm not alone in this by any stretch of the imagination, so I'm not trying to say I discovered this, but what I discovered when I read the Mesopotamian text in particular is that if you allow yourself to be freed of those academic prejudices and read about these wars, these are not metaphors. This is my other big beef with the alternative community. They want to see these wars as metaphors of planetary collisions and electric universes and electrodynamic solar systems and what have you, which may be true, but this is not the way the ancients wrote. The ancients wrote in a very deliberately multi-layered way. There's even an academic term for that. It's called paronomasia. And when they're describing these wars, they mean you to understand them, not just metaphorically, but literally. All right. These images work on a multitude of levels. So I began to look at these texts and I noticed something very interesting. Let's take the Lugalet and the Epic of Ninurta, for example, that I talk about in my book, The Cosmic War. In the Lugalet, which is usually understood by academics to be a creation epic, I defy anybody to read it and come away with the idea that it is anything else other than a war epic. And the war is between a goddess in the Mesopotamian pantheon by the name of Tiamat and Marduk. And when you read particularly the fourth tablet of that particular epic, when you read it, you will find descriptions of Tiamat using weather weapons, using chimerical, genetically engineered creatures like scorpion men, you know, whatever that may be. But in other words, you find things that are at once mythological and yet evocative of a technology.
Yeah.
And on Marduk's side, what do you have? Well, he has his invisibility cloak, which he speaks the word and he's invisible, and he speaks the word again and he's visible. And with this, he goes to fight the goddess Tiamat, with his divine thunderbolts and a divine wind, and he keeps hitting Tiamat with this divine wind and with these thunderbolts, and she's crying and wailing, and then he finally drives in the last thunderbolt, and she's killed. All right. Now, if you look at it carefully, Tiamat is also one of the descriptions or names of a planet. And driving winds into the planet, well, what's wind? Wind is a pressure wave. Mm-hmm. Wind is a longitudinal wave. What's a thunderbolt? Well, a thunderbolt is quite literally a lightning strike. It's extremely high voltage, direct current electricity, crashing through the atmosphere and ionizing the atmosphere and so on and so forth. So in other words, you're, again, Marduk's weapons are evocative of a technology. Mm-hmm. So in other words, I do think that if you read these texts, you have to read them with modern physics eyes, so to speak. And I'm not alone in that, because, of course, it was Robert Oppenheimer who cited the Rig Veda. You know, behold, I've become as death, the destroyer of worlds, at the Trinity atomic bombs test. So in other words, he's kind of cluing you in right there that at least one physicist, a very famous one, is looking at ancient texts in that way.
Yeah.
So I think we have to, you know, regardless of what academic philologists or so on and so forth may say, I think we have to look at those texts and take them seriously for what they say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too, and I think you do a great breakdown there. I mean, so to bridge the gap between that time and ours, do you think some elite from the previous age survived and set up our early civilizations?
My model, that's a great question. My model is basically that you know, the analogy I like to make, Greg, is let's pretend that this cosmic war is sort of the ancient war between the Western Allies and Germany. Let's use World War I as an analogy. Well, what happened at the end of World War I? Well, the Allies were pretty fed up with big German cannon and, you know, nasty infiltration tactics and airplanes and so on and so forth. So what did they do? At the Treaty of Versailles, they told Germany that, okay, you can't have a big army anymore. You can't have your great big huge cannon, and we're going to restrict you to the size of cannon that you can have. You can't have any tanks. You can't have airplanes, and no battleships over 10,000 tons displacement, okay? And to make sure that the Germans didn't do this, they appointed their military attachés to go around Germany and make darn good and sure the Germans weren't secretly making it, okay? Mm-hmm. So in other words, at the end of World War I, you had the victors prohibiting certain weapons and setting up a mechanism to sniff out the German war inventory and technology and prohibit any further development. So in other words, the Allies took an inventory and they did something else. If you read the Treaty of Versailles, they demilitarized the Rhineland, in other words, that whole area west of the Rhine, and a 30-mile wide belt on the east bank of the Rhine that had to be demilitarized. In other words, they set up a demilitarized quarantine zone around Germany in the west. Now, if you look at the cosmic war, what would happen there? Well, if you're blowing each other apart in this war, what's going to happen? The first thing that's going to happen is the victors are going to take an inventory of the defeated side's technology. Well, if you look at the Epic of Ninurta, which I reproduce in full in the Cosmic War, that's exactly what you see. In fact, if you read that so-called epic, you're going to be scratching your head, because if this is an epic, then it's one of the poorest written epics ever to have been composed, because it's like reading the index to a Sears catalog. There is not, you know, there's no character development. There's no plot. The whole thing is nothing but a list, an inventory of these magic stones after this war, some of which are carted away by the victors and used in other things, some of which are destroyed, and some of which cannot be destroyed. So what the victors do is they hide them. Okay. So in other words, you've got an elite that was set up after this war that was tasked with the cataloging and inventorying and destruction of some of these technologies, exactly as what we see in World War One.
Yes.
The other thing that you would do is, if you've really blown yourselves apart, you're going to create elites whose job it is to preserve as much of the knowledge of those civilizations as possible, pass them down, and begin the process of reconstruction. And this, too, is exactly what I think went on. Why? Because if you look, and I talk about this in a book called Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, if you look at the very ancient megalithic structures, the first thing you're going to do, if you have just blown your civilization apart, in order to get civilization jump-started, what do you have to have? Well, you have to have commerce. And in order to have commerce outside of your local area, what do you have to have? Well, you have to have a system of weights and measures that is not only accurate, but universally reproducible. Okay? And so, in other words, we can skip this academic nonsense that, well, they were using parts of the body to establish their measure. This is total nonsense, because if you're going to have an accurate system of weights and measures, which you need for any form of trade, the only way to have an accurate system of weights and measures is geodetic measures, geodetically based measures on the properties of the Earth itself, or astronomically based measures on the properties of the heavens that you can measure and reproduce. And this is what we see going on in these megalithic monuments. They're establishing systems of weights and measures. So in other words, yeah, you see clearly the action of these post-war elites when everything's been blown to hell. Because what are they doing? Well, they're trying to reconstruct as quickly as they can all over the world a system if you will, observatories that can reestablish these weights and measures.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a huge, huge thing. And, you know, it's entirely consistent with the pattern of a civilization that's just blown itself apart.
Totally, totally. And, I mean, I guess if you're dealing with such destructive power and you're coming out of that, barely, you know, one of the few survivors, I mean, not to seem like a sympathizer for the shadowy puppet masters, but there's a lot of incentive to keep the secret other than just greed and widespread money magic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is the other thing people have to understand. Let's say the United States and the Soviet Union actually did have a thermonuclear war and blew each other and most of the planet apart. Well, any survivors are going to be put in the position, you know, that we've all of a sudden lost a hugely developed modern civilization, and we're going to want to preserve as much of that knowledge as we can. We're going to want to hand it down in some way that the signal, the knowledge of that civilization, won't be lost in the noise. And we're also going to be probably put in the position where we're going to have to cooperate with the people that we just fought. So in other words, I think also that these post-cosmic war elites, if you will, were both the good elite and the bad elite, but for quite a long time, and under certain circumstances, they ally with each other just in order to get things going again. It's rather like, you know, Germany and Russia after World War One. You know, the Russians surrendered and then later the Germans surrendered. So having just been enemies, what are they going to do? Well, we'll make nice for a while so that we can both rebuild our defenses so that we can fight each other again.
Right, and the cycle continues. So to throw in a quick, more modern example of this weaponized tech, something that I've heard you talk about, I thought it was a really interesting analysis of what might have happened, but many people know about the mysterious Tunguska explosion.
Right.
But you've made the case that this could have been Tesla experimenting with the dark side of that energy. We know he was working on free energy, or so we're told, but this could be that other side.
Well, I first of all don't like the idea or the phrase free energy. I prefer, you know, zero point energy or vacuum flux energy or whatever you want to call it. It's free in the sense that it's out there, it surrounds us. I mean, even the energy put out by the sun is free in that sense, and we could tap into it. But I'm not the only, nor even the first one, that has offered the suggestion that Tesla may have something to do with Tunguska. There have certainly been others. What the other people that I've noticed that advance this hypothesis don't do is they don't point out that Tesla, after J.P. Morgan shut down his wireless transmission of power project on Long Island, what they don't do is they don't point out that Tesla then wrote a series of articles for the New York Times that were very bizarre. And in these articles, he suggested that this system of power could also be weaponized and that it would be capable of tremendous regional devastation if handled in a certain way. And from those comments, I hypothesized that maybe he, at some point, unbeknownst to his own laboratory assistants and Morgan, have turned that thing on and conducted experiments, and perhaps the experiments went wrong, which, you know, in Tesla's case are very unlikely, or that he simply decided, well, I'm going to target some wilderness region and, you know, see if this is really true, if I can really do this. So, yeah, I think it's at least a possibility that he might have done that.
Yeah, I think that is probably the best explanation for what that event could have been and the best visualization for the destructive power of this secret physics. So I find that really interesting.
Oh, yeah. I like to say, you know, if we're talking about the energy, you know, the zero point energy or the energy of space time or whatever, that if you can find a way to manipulate that or tap into it on the laboratory bench, so to speak, then the potential that you have there, the weaponization potential that you have, is something that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. it's, you know, there is, and I've said this too, there is a reason that the elites have suppressed this stuff. And it's not simply because they're greedy and so on, but a part of it is altruism. If you allowed a technology like that into the wrong hands, if we think Iran or nuclear proliferation and, you know, whatever little terrorist group getting their hands on the atom bomb is a problem, mm-hmm. Then imagine if you had a technology allowing you to do that. And if that fell into the wrong hands, and here's the other problem with this, that technology would be, from a certain point of view, much easier to engineer than building a hydrogen bomb. It would not require the same type of infrastructure or physical plant to produce that technology, and it would be relatively easier to hide. Mm. You wouldn't be able, in other words, to track nuclear proliferation by, you know, the amount of xenon-129 in the atmosphere above Tehran, you know, or wherever it is they're supposedly or allegedly making their bombs. So in other words, you've got a proliferation nightmare.
Yeah.
On your hands. So, you know, when Tesla starts talking about, you know, oh, by the way, J.P. Morgan and the rest of the country, you can also use this stuff as a weapon. You can kind of understand why at that juncture, Morgan may have pulled the plug.
Yeah, it's a different take for sure.
It's a different take. Yeah, absolutely.
I like it, though. I love a new perspective, and it's kind of rare sometimes in these conspiracy circles. But
yeah.
Wow. Well, Joseph.
Yeah.
this has been really great. It's been fun for me. I mean, a real memorable time for me. I'm a big fan, and I recommend your work to anyone.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you. So, well, before we really go, would you like to tell the people where they can buy your work so you get the most benefit, and maybe any other events or new stuff you're working on?
Yeah, they can go to my website, which is www.GizaDeathStar.com. That's all one word, all lowercase. Giza, like the place for the pyramids in Egypt. I do have a web store there that they can order all my books. The books do come from Amazon, but if they order off my website, I get a few extra penalties, or pardon me, a few extra pennies in royalties as kind of advertising fee for Amazon. So, you know, if you're going to order my books, please order them off the website rather than directly from Amazon. Right now, I'm working on another book in what I call my Nazi series of books. I should tell people that all of my books are written in kind of a preconceived order. They all dovetail into each other. You can read them in any order you want. You don't have to read them in the order that they're published in, but they are conceived in a kind of a deliberately preconceived order. And within that whole series of books, I have kind of sub-series of books, and I have, you know, a Nazi series, and I'm writing another book right now as kind of a book in that series of books.
Very awesome. Yeah, I love the structure to your books. I tried to kind of structure this conversation to kind of flow along with that, but very cool, man. Thanks again. It has been a blast. Hopefully we can do it again someday. And
sure.
Take care of yourself out there.
All right. Thank you, Greg. Thank you for having me on.
And boom goes the dynamite, people. I hope you liked that one as much as I did. Most of you are probably familiar with Joseph Farrell already, but I hope we extracted some nuggets that were new to you. Such a knowledgeable guy. And in the Plus Show, we keep on coming up through history, from the Khazars and Egyptians to Venice during the Renaissance and Middle Ages, to a little on banking families of China. Then we get into World War II, how this secret package of financial and physics-based info played maybe even the biggest role in the whole situation with the Nazis. And we talk about the resurgence of the Nazi International trying to regain a foothold in today's world, the Bilderbergs' role in channeling some of that money after the war, and then Joseph's breakdown of the modern-day chessboard. Pretty solid history lesson, I'd say. And I skipped over a couple other recorded interviews to place this next to the Gordon White Show, just to reiterate the point that I really don't think you can chalk everything up to the Jews or one particular group, you know? There might not be one history-long pyramid with one easy-to-define capstone. I think we might be talking about many pyramids and coups on the pyramid and secret information getting compartmentalized and then unleashed, and then you have a new head of the snake, not loyal to any other portion of it. And it just speaks to one of Gordon's larger points that human history is too complex for a singular narrative, and it can be tempting for us humans to learn a few data points and start running with an easy-to-understand narrative and parroting it from the rooftops like you know the whole story, and I think that just needs to be reeled back a little bit. Not to say a network of Khazars hasn't played a role, not to say Kabbalistic Jewish mystics haven't played a role, not to say that on the current chessboard, Israel isn't playing a major role. But then again, that's a country and isn't an indication of the thoughts and feelings of all the people that share its dirt. I mean, would you want to be pegged for the crimes of America? I sure wouldn't. So I think these two shows together present a more academic view, a more complex understanding, and it's kind of closer to where my true north really is as I get older. So these shows really resonate with me, and that obviously won't be true for everyone, and I'm sure we'll talk to many guests who have opposing views to each other and to myself as time goes on. I mean, that is the nature of the game. But people often ask me what I think about a lot of stuff and who I trust the most, and so when I get to talk to one of those guests or a couple of them, I guess I would reiterate in the post show that that's a person that I'd hang my hat on in a big way. And like Joseph said earlier, nobody has a monopoly on shady tactics. You know, one of the big problems for me in this realm is that so many guests get locked into the conspiracy bubble, and it's a shame because other big podcasts should really be bringing some of these guys on. And we're still kind of in the infancy of podcasting, and there's not a lot of crossover between shows like Red Ice and Coast to Coast and then big podcasts like The Nerdist or Adam Carolla or Joe Rogan. But there should be crossover, and I think that there can be. And I think if these bigger shows really wanted to impress their audience, they would dive into some of these guests.
Can you imagine breaking Joseph Farrell onto a show like Joe Rogan or Abby Martin? It would be a beautiful thing. And it's really up to the listeners and the fans of these people to make that happen. And on the subject of the power of the listening audience, some of you might be familiar with the wrestler Chris Jericho. I know I was a huge fan of his as a kid, actually. But he has a podcast, and he mentioned, I guess, that he wanted to get into conspiracies, and because some listeners of his and my show pushed him, he got in touch with me, and I might be going on his show in the next month or two. And my 13-year-old self would never believe that in my 30th year, Chris Jericho would be emailing me for something, but it's a weird world. I also got invited on the All Out show, which is a Sirius XM show, and that should be interesting too. I actually think that I'm better on the host side of the mic, but I am really psyched to be doing some of these really big shows. It's kind of odd. But thanks so much to everyone who has pushed for that. I mean, I would love to do more. Tell your Joe Rogans and your Adam Carollas and your Ari Shaffirs that they need a little Greg Carlwood in their lives. I guess I get a little bit better with each one I do. I was just on the Alex Cast not long ago. You might remember me interviewing Alex Bolin about tarot right before we went to Plus. Well, he had me on his show and we talked 2 hours of conspiracy goodness and we were all over the map, and that's totally enjoyable. You can check that out at AlexCast with two X's. And yeah, but keep contacting the shows you like and send them my way. Me or really any of the THC guests. Let's infect the digital mainstream. Also, you know, a big thanks to a couple of listeners who've sent me in things from the Amazon wish list. It's very appreciated. That list is old, and with Plus, I don't even feel right mentioning it. But people still come through on that with all kinds of little gifts and cool stuff, not only from Amazon, but their own things. It's hard for me to keep everybody's emails straight with the products in the mail, but I do want to say thanks. And, you know, if you are looking for my P.O. box, it's on thehiresidechats.com under Money Bomb. It's meant for people to send in those entries without paying, but, you know, also you could send me anything there. Also, my man over at Masato Toys, M-A-S-A-T-O Toys, he sent me a conspiratorial choose-your-own-adventure book about being the president, and I thought it was pretty clever. So check that out if you need a little gift for the conspiracy guy in your life. There's also another Crow article going up for you to check out if you've been following along there. I will say next week's show is with a guest you've probably never heard of about his provocative theory you've probably never considered. And he's not a very polished speaker and reads a lot of his responses, which is its own type of awkwardness. But overall, I'd say it's a good time. And until then, I'll be at Contact in the Desert. Your move, financial physicists of the shadowy elite. Your frickin' move.
No one knows what it's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man. Behind blue eyes, and no one knows what it's like to be hated, to be faded, to telling only lies. But my dreams aren't as empty as my conscience seems to be. I have hours only lonely since they exposed me on THC. No one knows what it's like to feel these feelings like I do, and I blame you. No one bites back as hard on their anger. None of my pain and woe can show through. But my dreams aren't as empty as my conscience seems to be. I have hours always lonely since they exposed me. see.
As you mop up the remnants of your melted mind, consider this. The high-quality, commercial-free show you just enjoyed is what we call THC-free. But you can spend twice as much time with Greg Carlwood and all his great guests by becoming a member of the Higher Side Chats Elite for just $5. And you'll get the 5 extended 2-hour episodes that come out each month. Because an honest, open-minded, and uncensored exploration into the fringe will never be brought to you by your corporate overlords, but rather must be funded by the loyal listeners willing to take that ride. So join at thehiresidechatsplus.com, and on top of twice as much show, get your own easy-to-use RSS feed URL for convenient listening on any device. Suggest guests on your member profile, comb through the archives of all the ones you missed, and continue the conversation even further on the new THC Plus Forum, where you can scratch that higher side itch in between shows with the rest of us and hold your head up high, knowing that your subscription supports a show you love, produces the free version for everyone else, and stands as a small act of rebellion against those nefarious puppet masters of the power pyramid. Treat yourself. It's time.